the left-hand edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, TV lies, left-handed paradox, cell phones, anti-vax, subatomic particles, fundamental forces, and a lot more. Let's begin episode 303.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, a plethora of web wisdom, misconceptions from TV, 9 things that actually expire, who invented the internet, the left-handed paradox, left versus right brains, weird involuntary behaviors, the science of anti-vax, your cell phone and cancer, subatomic knowledge, and the fundamental forces. I hope you've enjoyed what I've gathered here for you today. So let's start off with TV lies.
Hi, I'm Elliot, and this is Mental Floss. Today I'm going to talk about some misconceptions that television, my favorite thing, taught you. Misconception number one, it takes a few seconds to scan for fingerprints. On shows like CSI and Law & Order, the characters seem to have these unlimited resources. Instant fingerprint scanning and recognition is one of those. In reality, they would probably use the FBI's integrated automated fingerprint identification system. It takes around 27 minutes to search through its 70 million criminal fingerprints. Processing for a civilian's print takes an average of an hour and 12 minutes to search through 34 million prints. Misconception number two, forensic labs are 100% accurate. This misconception is so common that it's even been given a name, the CSI effect. It has been studied because jurors who watch the show are less likely to be convinced by evidence unless it involves forensic science. In reality, according to the Washington Post, between 2002 and 2012, quote, failures were reported at about 30 federal, state, and local crime labs serving the FBI, the Army, and 8 of the nation's 20 largest cities. A study was actually conducted at Arizona State University about the CSI effect in 2007. One forensic scientist that they interviewed estimated that 40% of the science portrayed on CSI does not exist in real life. Shocker. Yet, viewers of CSI tend to rate themselves higher than other people when asked about their knowledge of forensic science. Misconception number three, police officers always need warrants to search. In many crime shows, an officer is thwarted when they're forced to wait for a search warrant. But in reality, that's not always necessary. Like when a person consents to a search, when there's probable cause, when something illegal is in plain view, or when a suspect is being arrested. Misconception number four, air ducts are easy to crawl through. Characters have used air ducts to get around in shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 24, and even Community, if you count monkeys. This isn't a good idea in real life for a few reasons. First of all, many shows have characters escaping from being locked up through a duct, which wouldn't work well because it actually makes a lot of noise. You get caught pretty much right away. Plus, ducts are used to transport air from place to place, so it could easily bend in a 90-degree angle that you wouldn't be able to crawl up or down. Finally, many people have gotten stuck in air ducts. They're generally built a little too small to transport people. I wonder if that's on purpose. Probably. Misconception number five, when a person's heart starts flatlining, a shock to the heart can save them. You've seen this in basically like every medical show ever. A patient's heart monitor indicates that it's flatlining, and then a good-looking doctor rushes in and saves the day with a shock to the heart. But a flatline, also known as a systole, can be fixed with CPR or with a vasopressor and adrenaline. This is for very complicated scientific reasons that I don't really have time to get into, so I'll just quickly talk about when the shocks do and don't work. Basically, when someone is in cardiac arrest, a shock to the heart can cause electrolytes out of cells within the heart. Due to the different electrical charges of those electrolytes, the heart might start pumping again. A person who is flatlined, on the other hand, doesn't have those different electrical charges that those electrolytes need for this to work. A shock to a flatlined heart will just burn it. Misconception number six, affairs, lies, and murder are rampant in the White House. Some shows portray a career in politics as the most dangerous thing you could possibly pursue. It's actually not that way in real life, at least according to Barack Obama, that is. While talking about scandal, he has said, it's not that exciting, noting that staffers don't have enough time to engage in too much scandalous behavior. Misconception number seven, minimum wage workers can afford beautiful, spacious apartments. Bankrate.com recently consulted a few real estate brokers to see just how much television apartments would cost in real life. And two broke girls, Max and Carolyn, live in a fairly small apartment in Williamsburg. In reality, it would probably cost around $2,000 a month in rent. The apartments in the Big Bang Theory would be around the same cost, which might be feasible for a group of scientists, but maybe not a Cheesecake Factory employee like Penny. Misconception number 8, crimes are solved most of the time by the tons of people who work in that field. Let's be honest, shows like CSI and Law & Order can be real downers. Well, it turns out these shows have a kind of optimism as well, because Detective Olivia Benson and her various television peers are very, very good at their jobs. They solve pretty much 100% of the cases that they see. In reality, the NYPD solves around 57% of homicides. Interestingly, people who watch these shows often also overestimate the percentage of the population who are lawyers and police officers. A 2009 study from Purdue University found that these people believed lawyers made up around 16% of the workforce and police officers were around 18%. In reality, it's less than 1% each. Misconception number 9, eyewitnesses are always accurate. Courtroom dramas rarely tackle the subject of inaccurate eyewitnesses. Generally, what they say is what the viewer also saw happen, but oftentimes, eyewitnesses misremember events and misidentify suspects. In fact, according to the American Psychological Association, quote, controlled experiments as well as studies of actual identifications have consistently found that the rate of incorrect identifications is approximately 33%. Guys, that's 1 in 3. Misconception number 10, emergency room workers are constantly saving people from heart attacks and strokes. I'm not going to tell you when to go to the emergency room and when not to go, but shows like ER and Grey's Anatomy really confuse their viewers about what the ER is all about. Chest pain and abdominal pain are the two most common symptoms for people visiting emergency rooms. But, unlike on TV, these visits generally don't end in a doctor saving life. People visiting the ER who are actually experiencing heart attacks, strokes, or appendicitis are in the minority.
The CDC was just caught using expired disinfectant in their labs, which got me thinking, disinfectant expires? What? Howdy gang, Trace here with some D-News for you. The CDC's use of expired cleanser was discovered after 75 employees were accidentally exposed to live anthrax last month, and the USDA stepped in to look at their procedures to see who screwed up. Most labs use bleach as their disinfectant because the active ingredient hypochlorous acid causes the proteins in bacteria to unfold and the bacteria to die. Bleach is what was being used by the CDC in their labs, and it has an expiration date of only 6 months from the date of manufacture, so like 3 to 5 months once you get it home. It expires because the sodium hypochlorite decomposes over time. The cooler the storage area, the better, but bleach manufactured and stored in the summer months will degrade faster. Expiration dates are used by manufacturers not to tell you it's time to throw this away, but more to say we can't guarantee that this product is perfect anymore. The dates are usually printed on the product, and there are lots and lots of them. The latex in a condom has an expiration date of 5 years because the latex needs to be moist. And after 5 years, the brand can't guarantee the latex hasn't degraded from drying. If it has spermicide, that life is even shorter. It's only 3 years. Like with bleach, spermicide's active ingredient degrades over time. Sunscreen also expires, mainly because the tiny particles inside the solution clump together as the sunscreen ages. This decreases the effectiveness and causes the sunscreen to eventually become crappy. Mascara expires after 2 or 3 months. So if you're going to splurge on that fancy lash lengthening formula, use it all. Why? Because your eyes are dirty. And once it's been used, the mascara becomes a breeding ground for bacteria. After the date, the bacteria could have built up enough to cause eye infections like conjunctivitis or pink eye. And you should definitely get rid of your loofah after 3 to 4 weeks. Bacteria, folks, it's growing on your stuff. Other than bacteria, it's all about the active ingredients. Anti-acne creams usually break down within 3 months of first opening, sometimes sooner if they're natural. Hair gel and hairspray last 2 to 3 years. Soap usually expires in 18 months to 2 years, especially if it contains essential oils. Soap is made of lye, which is a generic term for an alkaline solution, and a collection of fats. So over time, the lye gets less potent and the fats degrade. Are you sensing a pattern here? It's not just bathroom stuff, though. Motor oil is organic. It used to be tiny plants and animals, remember? Fossil fuels? Like all the other things, once it's open, the air begins to break it down, and after 90 days, it's expired. Unopened, it might last 5 years. Alkaline batteries last 5 years too, and the chemicals inside the batteries will only hold a charge for so long. Because their elements are different, lithium batteries can last as long as 10 years. There are a lot of things with expiration dates, and while you might not have to pay attention to them all the time, the CDC bleach, by the way, would still be okay if it was maybe 9 months after manufacture, but every month more, the acid is depleted, and then eventually it doesn't work. Hopefully the CDC will pony up for some new cleaner, and so should you. Kind of makes those trips to Costco to buy 100 soaps seem kind of silly, doesn't it? There are two things that I found that never expire, by the way. Honey and nail polish remover. Yeah, so that's good to know, I guess.
So, have you ever wondered who actually invented the internet? Some people have become zillionaires thanks to the internet, but all they did was invent clever ways of using the internet. So the person who invented the internet should be a gazillionaire equivalent to, say, God, shouldn't they? Who should get the credit then? Was it a British geek in a Swiss underground lab? Maybe. Clever Americans threatened with nuclear annihilation by the Russians? Nice idea. French scientists who decided to call their computer network the
L'Internet.
Interesting. Or was it thanks to a myriad of smart scientists working on something they knew was useful but didn't realize would be so big? Well, let's try and get some facts straight. There's the internet, a whole bunch of computer networks connected to each other, and then there's the World Wide Web, a way of making it easier to share information using all those interconnected computers. The internet as we know it today was at least 40 years in the making. One popular but wrong story is that the internet was developed by the USA so they had a communication network that would survive a nuclear war. According to one of the founders of the first network, the ARPANET, in the 1960s, this first network experiment wasn't about communication at all. It was about optimizing processor usage, or time sharing, which basically meant that scientists could share computer power too. That was because until the 1960s, there was basically no network. You had big machines called mainframes, which sat in a room and processed computing tasks one at a time. With time sharing, these behemoths could process several tasks at a time, which meant their power could be used by several scientists at once. And obviously, once you start connecting computers together, you start to wonder about what you need to do to make communications between them easier. Scientists around the world were trying to solve this problem. So let's look at some of the other key concepts that were developed elsewhere. Starting with packet switching. In Britain, there was a commercial network developed by the National Physical Laboratory, but which never really got off the ground because it didn't get funding. But they did come up with the idea of packet switching, a way of avoiding congestion in busy networks by cutting up data at one end and putting it back together at the other. The French also played a role. They were working on a scientific network called Cyclades, but they didn't have a big budget, so they decided to work on direct connections between computers as opposed to working with gateway computers. Now, as an aside here, this admittedly isn't very scientific, but according to one theory, a spin-off of their research was the word Internet. But you don't have to believe it if you don't want to. So, now it's the early 1970s. There's quite a lot of computer infrastructure, but communication is awkward and patchy because different networks can't talk to each other. TCP/IP solves this problem. The TCP/IP protocols form the basic communication language of the internet, which labels the packets of data and makes sure that even though some pieces of the same data take a different route, they all arrive at their destination and can be reassembled. Networks really began communicating with each other in 1975. So you could argue that was the beginning of the internet. Email was also very important. It was developed for ARPANET in 1972. Most internet traffic in 1976 was email, because academics thought electronic post-it notes were dead cool. With networks that could talk to each other, communication was becoming easier. But all this communication was just text-based, and it was pretty ugly to look at. In the 1980s, a Brit called Timothy Berners-Lee spent time with CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, where physicists are trying to work out what the universe is made of. He wanted to manage the scientists' information and make it possible for them to share and interconnect their work easily, making progress more likely. He did so by inventing an interface using HTTP, HTML, and URLs that made internet browsers possible. He called his browser the World Wide Web. So he didn't invent the internet, but he did invent the web. The first ever website which he created was at CERN in France in August 1991. So, once the initial infrastructure was in place, the key technologies had been invented, internet message boards exploded in the 1980s, the phone companies saw the commercial potential of digital communication, web browsers spread like wildfire in the early 1990s, and ordinary people discovered email. Then, the internet expanded rapidly and steadily and became workable for the masses from about 1995. Hold on, didn't US Vice President Al Gore invent the internet? No. And if you read what he said exactly, you'd know he never claimed to have done. But many people credit him with energetically pushing legislation that encouraged the spread of the internet. The internet exists because we need to communicate, and most of us like doing it. That's why humans have become the dominant species on Earth. You could argue that the internet is a natural evolutionary step and a manifestation of that need. It wasn't invented by anyone in particular, but when the building blocks were put together by all those cool scientists from all over the place, the internet became a communication tool, a retail tool, a research tool, a propaganda tool, a spying tool, a shopping tool, a dating tool, an entertainment tool, and a way of skiving off work while making it look like you're working or studying, which is what you may be doing now. Ultimately, though, you're communicating. Especially if you leave a comment, and that might make you a better human being.
I hope you enjoyed that set. We'll be back after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. So the next set we have up for you is, why are some people left-handed? Why hasn't evolution just eliminated this trait? Is it true that some people are left-brained and others are right-brained? And of course, five, involuntary behaviors. What's up with our sneezing? So let's listen, and I hope you enjoy.
If you know an older left-handed person, chances are they had to learn to write or eat with their right hand. And in many parts of the world, it's still common practice to force children to use their proper hand. Even the word for right also means correct or good, not just in English, but many other languages too. But if being left-handed is so wrong, then why does it happen in the first place? Today, about one-tenth of the world's population are left-handed. Archaeological evidence shows that it's been that way for as long as 500,000 years. With about 10% of human remains showing the associated differences in arm length and bone density, and some ancient tools and artifacts showing evidence of left-hand use. And despite what many may think, handedness is not a choice. It can be predicted even before birth, based on the fetus's position in the womb. So if handedness is inborn, does that mean it's genetic? Well, yes and no. Identical twins who have the same genes can have different dominant hands. In fact, this happens as often as it does with any other sibling pair. But the chances of being right or left-handed are determined by the handedness of your parents in surprisingly consistent ratios. If your father was left-handed but your mother was right-handed, you have a 17% chance of being born left-handed, while two righties will have a left-handed child only 10% of the time. Handedness seems to be determined by a roll of the dice, but the odds are set by your genes. All of this implies there's a reason that evolution has produced this small proportion of lefties and maintained it over the course of millennia. And while there have been several theories attempting to explain why handedness exists in the first place, or why most people are right-handed, a recent mathematical model suggests that the actual ratio reflects a balance between competitive and cooperative pressures on human evolution. The benefits of being left-handed are clearest in activities involving an opponent, like combat or competitive sports. For example, about 50% of top hitters in baseball have been left-handed. Why? Think of it as a surprise advantage. Because lefties are a minority to begin with, both right-handed and left-handed competitors will spend most of their time encountering and practicing against righties. So when the two face each other, the left-hander will be better prepared against this right-handed opponent, while the righty will be thrown off. This fighting hypothesis, where an imbalance in the population results in an advantage for left-handed fighters or athletes, is an example of negative frequency-dependent selection. But according to the principles of evolution, groups that have a relative advantage tend to grow until that advantage disappears. If people were only fighting and competing throughout human evolution, natural selection would lead to more lefties being the ones that made it, until there were so many of them that it was no longer a rare asset. So in a purely competitive world, 50% of the population would be left-handed. But human evolution has been shaped by cooperation as well as competition, and cooperative pressure pushes handedness distribution in the opposite direction. In golf, where performance doesn't depend on the opponent, only 4% of top players are left-handed, an example of the wider phenomenon of tool sharing. Just as young potential golfers can more easily find a set of right-handed clubs, many of the important instruments that have shaped society were designed for the right-handed majority. Because lefties are worse at using these tools and suffer from higher accident rates, they would be less successful in a purely cooperative world, eventually disappearing from the population. So by correctly predicting the distribution of left-handed people in the general population, as well as matching data from various sports, the model indicates that the persistence of lefties as a small but stable minority reflects an equilibrium that comes from competitive and cooperative effects playing out simultaneously over time. And the most intriguing thing is what the numbers can tell us about various populations. From the skewed distribution of pawedness in cooperative animals to the slightly larger percentage of lefties in competitive hunter-gatherer societies. We may even find that the answers to some puzzles of early human evolution are already in our hands.
There are plenty of personality tests out there that claim to tell you which side of your brain controls how you think, what you're good at, basically who you are. They might say that you're a creative right-brainer doomed to perform poorly in math and science. Guess you better give up on getting into MIT. Or they might tell you that you're logical left-brainer, a regular Mr. Spock, terrible in the arts, so much for Juilliard. But you may have noticed that there are more than just two types of people in the world, and they're not all either scientists or artists. So there has to be some flaw in that whole left-brain, right-brain thing. Even if you never bought into the myth, your high school textbooks probably taught you that the right half of your brain processes creative tasks, and the left half can handle math or form language. And that is a real thing. Different sides of the brain are often responsible for different tasks. It's just that pop psychology has taken the idea a little too far. So it's time to set the record straight about your brain and you. It all started way back in the 19th century when doctors realized that the two halves of the brain might not be identical. They noticed that when someone injured one side of their head, it affected some brain processes like language or emotion more than others. But it wasn't until 1961 that a neurobiologist named Roger Walcott Sperry set out to fill in the blanks along with a graduate student he was working with at the time, Michael Gazzaniga. Sperry's research over the next few years would completely change the way the neuroscience community thought about the human brain. But in the process, he also accidentally created a myth that would plague popular culture for decades. Sperry studied patients with severe epilepsy who had elected to undergo a surgery called a commissurotomy. This involved completely severing the corpus callosum, a bundle of nerve fibers that connects the two hemispheres of the brain and allows them to communicate with each other. You'd think that effectively chopping their brains in half would be a big deal, and it was, but the side effects, like problems with memory, were relatively minor compared with the benefit of not having seizures anymore. Since the brain hemispheres in these patients basically went about their business independently, Sperry figured that studying them would be a great way to find out what happened on each side of the brain. All he needed were some simple tests. He already knew that the right hemisphere controlled the left side of the body, and the left hemisphere controlled the right. So he and Gazzaniga devised an experiment in which they'd display an object on a screen to the subjects in such a way that it would only be processed by their right hemispheres. The best way to do that was just to make sure that only their left half-visual field was seeing it. Because of the way the optic nerves are set up, that's not the same as just covering the patient's right eye. Instead, Sperry had the patients focus on the center of a screen and then flash the image on the left or right-hand side of the screen. The flash went by too quickly for them to follow it with both fields of vision. So when Sperry showed an object of a picture on the left side of their screens, he found that the subjects noticed it, but they couldn't name it. If that object was, let's say, a picture of a key, their right hemispheres knew that they were seeing a shiny object, but they couldn't come up with the word key. Since the subjects were lacking that connection between two hemispheres, Sperry concluded that language had to be processed by the left side of the brain, which his subjects couldn't connect to. He kept testing the patients with similar tasks that tested other basic processes and eventually found a pattern. Language and calculation seemed to be done on the left and spatial reasoning on the right. Over time, that's been simplified to logic on the left and creativity on the right. But simplifying is not a great idea when dealing with something as complicated as a brain. Sperry himself described the results as highly statistical, just reflecting a general pattern and not an absolute rule. There even turned out to be some people who show the reverse pattern, usually left-handed people, and their mental capabilities aren't any worse for wear. Still, his research was a huge deal at the time, and Sperry was eventually awarded a Nobel Prize for his work in understanding the specialization of the two hemispheres of the brain. But even though he cautioned against generalizing his research too much, an article appeared in 1973 in the New York Times Magazine titled, "We Are Left-Brained, or Right-Brained," describing Sperry's research in oversimplified terms. Then there was an article in Time Magazine that did the same thing. The rest is popular psychology history. A bevy of self-help books and personality tests soon popped up, claiming that some people were guided by the logical left brain and some by the creative right brain. So now there were two new ideas going around. One, that different processes occurred exclusively on different sides of the brain, and two, that people were more prone to one side's strength than the other. But only one of those concepts, that each hemisphere controlled different processes, was actually based on Sperry's research. Known as brain lateralization, the concept basically became neuroscience canon. And evolutionarily, there were a lot of reasons that it made sense. Like, it's not efficient for both hemispheres to be required for us to perform every single task. Split up the functions between two hemispheres, and you can multitask. Scientists were even able to test this using baby chicks. They found that chicks that tended to use their brain hemispheres separately managed to forage for food and keep an eye out for predators, but the ones with more distributed brain function couldn't do both at once. In evolutionary terms, not being able to watch your back is bad news for species. There's also the matter of brain traffic jams. The corpus callosum is something of an information bottleneck, which means that the brain has to be selective about what information it sends back and forth between hemispheres. Just like delegating tasks within a group of people, it's much more efficient to let each hemisphere take responsibility for a particular job. And finally, putting one hemisphere in charge of certain things just helps keep the peace in the brain. If both sides tried to process the same situation all the time, each would come up with completely different responses, which would be confusing. So the concept of brain lateralization itself made perfect sense. But turning the concept of delegating processes into the idea that some people could be left-brained or right-brained, Sperry never suggested that at all. Which is why, when in 2013 a group of American researchers set out to analyze over 1,000 brain scans, they figured it might be time to debunk that myth once and for all. The researchers analyzed a type of brain scan called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. fMRI shows the parts of the brain that are active by tracking the flow of oxygenated blood through different regions. The blood brings oxygen and nutrients to the more active parts of the brain, and areas with more blood flow show up as bright webs on the scan. So the researchers looked at scans of over 1,000 healthy, uninjured brains in what's known as the resting state, where the subjects aren't asked to perform any particular task, but there's still brain activity because they're not dead. If certain areas showed up brighter on the scan, it would mean that those parts of the brain were more active and interconnected. And if one whole hemisphere showed more bright areas than the other while the subject was basically doing nothing, that meant they probably had a dominant hemisphere. It would be evidence that some people were left-brained or right-brained. Now, the researchers were expecting that certain areas would light up more brightly than others at rest. There are brain regions that are associated with things like language and paying attention, and those did light up more. So it seemed that even in the resting state, specific processes were divvied up between hemispheres, confirming Sperry's findings. But the scans didn't show that any one hemisphere was consistently showing up any more or less brightly than the other in subjects. In over 1,000 brain scans, they didn't find a pattern of people who had more strongly connected right hemispheres than the left, or left over right. As far as the authors of the study could tell, there are no Vulcans among us. In other words, there is no such thing as an inherently left or right-brained person. Now, the idea of brain lateralization is still a really important development in our understanding of our brains, but it, too, is probably a lot more complicated than it's often been made out to be. Like, even though particular tasks tend to be handled by different hemispheres, the whole point is that the two are constantly talking to each other to make even simple jobs possible. Ask someone to do something like invent a new word, for instance, and they'll need creativity from the right hemisphere, but also language from the left. So people can still have particular intellectual talents, obviously, but being good at math doesn't necessarily make you bad at writing fan fiction. I mean, you can't have Sherlock without Watson or Bert without Ernie. Your brain is a dynamic duo, and it's incredibly versatile, and you might as well give it the credit it deserves.
We'd like to think we walk through our lives completely conscious, free to choose whatever we like, totally, completely in control. Not even close. Our bodies leave a lot to autopilot, which is a good thing, because imagine having to regulate your heartbeat and your breathing and your digestive system and your body temperature, all while not peeing your pants and falling down. That would be hard. Many of those involuntary actions are mysterious, annoying, and just plain weird. Here are five of the human body's strangest out-of-control behaviors. Start typing "why does my" into Google, and the top result is an eye-opener. Involuntary twitching of the muscles around the eye has a number of causes, including dry eyes, caffeine, bright lights, and just like during a tough workout, from simple fatigue. It's usually totally harmless and eventually goes away on its own. And it's a good hint that you've probably been looking at that screen enough for one day. Looking at bright light can cause more than an eye twitch. In Aristotle's Book of Problems, he asks, why is it that one sneezes more after one has looked at the sun? Proving that people have been asking a lot of the same questions for a long time, and no one told Aristotle that you're not supposed to stare at the sun. Like, ever. The so-called photic sneeze reflex, aka the autosomal cholinergic helioophthalmic outburst, abbreviated ACHU, yes, seriously, is experienced by about 1 in 4 people, leading scientists to believe that it is genetically heritable. While the exact cause hasn't been pinpointed, many scientists think that it's due to crosstalk between the optic nerve and the nerve that feeds the tickling sensation in your nose. The visual cortex of sun-sneezing people is also prone to overstimulation, which might send the sneeze-sensing parts of their brain haywire. Have you ever been just about to go to sleep, walking through the gates to dreamland, only to have the floor pulled out from under you and suddenly you're falling and then you wake up? These frustrating sleep starts have another cool medical name, hypnagogic myoclonus. When we drift off, the areas of our brain that control motor function are inactivated in favor of those that control our sleep cycles, which is why you can dream about riding your bike without actually moving your feet. As the sleepy part of your brain fights with the awake and moving parts of your brain, that battle can spontaneously tip back in favor of the motor control side, and then suddenly you're like, ugh, whoa, I'm awake. Sleep starts aren't the only myoclonae that we experience. Hiccups are an uncontrollable contraction of the diaphragm muscle that we use to draw air into our lungs. About a quarter second after that muscle contracts, the vocal cords snap shut, creating that characteristic. Scientists still aren't sure what causes them, but possible explanations include hiccups being an evolutionary remnant from a few hundred million years ago when our ancestors still had to pump water over their gills. Or, since hiccups mainly happen in mammals, that they started as a way for nursing infants to clear air from their stomachs. If you want to get rid of hiccups, it seems that increasing the amount of CO2 in your blood can do the job, which is why common remedies include drinking water, or holding our breath, or breathing into a paper bag. Yawning, another long, slow, involuntary form of breathing, is common throughout the animal kingdom, and it even happens in the womb. We know it's associated with sleep and boredom, but that doesn't explain why it happens. And like most human behaviors, if you stop and think about yawning long enough, it starts to become a really weird thing to do. Hippocrates believed that yawns released noxious fumes that had built up in the body, but modern medicine has shown us that that usually happens on the other end of the body. We also know that about 50% of people who observe a yawn will yawn in response, so it's thought to be a social cue to synchronize our biological clocks. One theory says yawns might even cool the brain slightly to make us more alert as we get bored or sleepy. Even watching someone talk for extended periods of time can induce yawning. So next time you're getting bored in class, tell your teacher it's Mother Nature's fault. Finally, I'll leave you with one bonus behavior, post-micturition convulsion syndrome, or the pee shivers. This is another behavior for which scientists haven't quite shaken out all the details, but some believe it's simply because we're exposing sensitive areas of our body to the cold while we expel some internal warmth. They might also arise from a bit of conflict between our autonomous nervous system that's usually quietly keeping all that pee inside and the part of our conscious mind that's in charge of the plumbing at that moment. These weird, wild, and often twitchy behaviors may defy nice, neat explanations, and yes, sometimes they are very annoying. But in the great movie that is life, they're a nice reminder of all the amazing things going on behind the scenes.
I hope you enjoyed that. It's time for another break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. So the next two I've got for you is Science of Anti-Vaccination and Can Cell Phones Really Cause Cancer? Let's enjoy.
We haven't talked about the vaccine debate here on SciShow because there is no debate to have. Vaccines don't cause autism, and they save millions of lives every year. But there is a debate, whether or not it makes sense. And a lot of people counter this with ridicule, but we at SciShow aren't about judgment, we're about science and using it to better understand the world. We see the anti-vaccination movement as a phenomenon to be understood. So instead of making yet another statement about how yes, vaccines are good, and no, they don't cause autism, let's use science to understand why fewer and fewer people are getting their children vaccinated. I'm Hank Green, and this is SciShow. First, let's discuss how we ended up with this imagined link between vaccinations and autism in the first place. Autism diagnoses are definitely on the rise. Now, many scientists believe that this is largely or even completely because of more effective diagnosis and changes in how the diagnosis is reported. So while the diagnoses of autism are increasing, we can't say for sure whether the incidence of autism is also increasing. If it is, it must be because of some environmental factor. Now, when we talk about autism, we're really referring to a range of developmental disorders which can affect a person's ability to communicate or socialize, or cause them to develop patterns of behavior that become pretty specific and inflexible. The condition can manifest itself in a lot of different ways, but you've probably heard of them referred to together as autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. While ASD has been found to have some strong genetic components to it, there also seem to be environmental factors at work as well. And that's really the root of this controversy. We simply don't know precisely what causes autism. And in the absence of explanations, people try to make sense of it themselves, and the way our brains do that is almost entirely with cognitive bias. A cognitive bias is really just anything that skews how we process and interpret new information. There are tons of different kinds of bias. Some biases cause us to ignore certain data, others lead us to put too much emphasis on certain data. They can even drive us to focus on facts that are actually irrelevant to what we're observing. But essentially, when we hear a hypothesis and think, yeah, that makes sense, really what we're saying is, yeah, that fits with my cognitive biases. And so people blame all sorts of things for autism. Plastics, pesticides, the use of antidepressants during pregnancy, GMOs, sugar, gut bacteria, and vaccines. Basically, you start with whatever makes the most sense to the person doing the hypothesizing. The onset of autism typically happens in one of two ways. Either parents notice a delay in language development, typically around the first birthday, or they notice an apparently sudden loss of existing development, which might happen all the way through the third birthday. Now, humans are pattern recognition machines. We need to be able to figure out what behaviors and strategies lead to positive outcomes. But even more than that, we're on the lookout for things that lead to negative outcomes. This overweighting of negative outcomes is a well-known psychological effect called negativity bias. So imagine you wake up one morning and your car doesn't work. Your brain is gonna wanna know what happened. Did you leave your lights on? Did you drive through a huge puddle yesterday and maybe shorted something out? There has to be some reason why it won't start. On the other hand, if you get in a 15-year-old car and it starts up just fine after having had a bad week of barely getting going, you tend not to wonder what went right. We spend far more cognitive resources attempting to figure out why a bad thing happened than we do trying to determine why something good happened. In psychology, the search for these explanations is called explanatory attribution, and different people have different explanatory styles. Some people are more prone to blame themselves, while others search for an external event to blame. But one thing is clear, we are very bad at not blaming anything. It's not surprising that parents of children with autism, especially parents who notice a sudden loss of previous development, will search for a possible cause. And when the most significant recent event in the health of a child was a vaccination, as can be said for many moments in the life of a young American, we might identify that as a potential cause and deem that link worthy of further examination. Now, this is completely logical. The problem is that over a dozen peer-reviewed papers have found no correlation between autism and the MMR vaccine, or any other vaccine for that matter. And yet, when you Google vaccines and autism, a fair number of the results claim that there is a link between the two, and that that link is being covered up either by the government or by big corporations. A parent, already experiencing frustration with the medical community's inability to tell them why this thing has happened to their child, will, on the internet, find a vibrant community of similarly frustrated people who share their values and experiences. These communities are full of anecdotes that draw connections between vaccines and autism, and so, unsurprisingly, some people become convinced that they have found the reason for their child's disability. Once their mind has been made up, confirmation bias sets in. Confirmation bias is simply our tendency to more readily and with less scrutiny accept information, anecdotes, and worldviews that confirm our existing beliefs. And again, it is a completely normal thing that every person does. Indeed, trying to convince someone that a previously held belief is incorrect has been proven to actually increase their affinity for that idea. And so a community is born, and the safety of vaccines is called into question. And once the procedure for getting a vaccine goes from the doctor telling you that it is now time for a vaccine, and 99% of parents agreeing because that person went through medical school, to it being a question to ponder, vaccination rates will go down. A 2011 study showed that parents who think about vaccines before their child is born are 8 times less likely to vaccinate their children. Basically, when given an opportunity to do research on their own, what they find is confusing. And when confused, the default choice is to simply take no action. And this is an example of yet another bias called omission bias. In effect, we judge harmful actions as less moral than harmful inactions or omissions. In fact, a frequently cited study found that when the choice to vaccinate is framed as an action, the average parent will only vaccinate their child if not vaccinating is at least 2 times more dangerous than vaccinating. This has to do with our perception of future regret. Parents report that they'll feel worse if they take an action and it harms their child than if they don't act and the child is harmed by a failure to act. This perception of potential regret can be so strong that even bringing up the choice of acting versus non-acting seems to be counterproductive. A 2013 study found that attempts to convince parents to vaccinate their children actually decreased the percentage who went on to choose vaccination. If vaccination is presented as a personal choice instead of a necessity for good public health, then potentially harmful inaction can seem more moral than potentially harmful action, and vaccination rates go down. Parents are choosing to let nature take its course. And as you might expect, this effect is much stronger in people with a measurable naturalness bias. This is just a tendency to perceive things that come from nature as being inherently less threatening than things that we invent ourselves. One way psychologists measure this bias is by asking a subject if they'd prefer a substance extracted from an herb or one synthesized in a lab, even if they're chemically identical. And of course, others have biases against big government or big corporations, and these ideas about vaccinations fit well with those worldviews. Confirmation bias at work again. But even people who don't hold these biases end up being more likely not to vaccinate if they start doing research before their baby is born. This is because of another failure of the human brain. We are terrible at what psychologists call risk perception. Given the merest sliver of a possibility that vaccines will cause developmental disorders, parents are now weighing a disease they have seen, autism, against diseases they have never seen. Since the 1970s, measles has been pretty much unheard of. The measles doesn't scare people my age for the same reason a giant man-eating squirrel doesn't scare us. We've never seen it. Risk perception is basically a science all on its own, and we've found that vague future hazards, like the future probability of an illness, are far less frightening than immediate specific hazards, like the sudden onset of autism. So amazingly, the success of vaccines is one of the reasons that people are less likely to vaccinate their children. So yes, it turns out humans are complicated, and this is a complicated problem. Humans are inherently bad at understanding the effects of self-selecting samples, like online anti-vaccine forums, and often completely unable to accept that a negative outcome could really be the result of something that's beyond their control, and still not very well understood. This is not an anti-vaxxer problem. It's a human problem. Those of us who trust science or have built an understanding of statistics and bias simply have had different lives than people who more heavily weight anecdotes or the opinions of their friends or strangers they meet online who feel the same way. So next time you find yourself frustrated about the decline in vaccinations in America, remember that it's only because of the dramatic success of vaccines that we could even think of having this debate. And those anti-vaccine activists are being driven by the exact same logic traps and cognitive biases that every one of us suffers from. Only by understanding and accepting these psychological pitfalls that we're all so susceptible to will we be able to solve this problem, and that is what science is all about.
I can't speak for you, but lots of my friends go into a tizzy when groups like the World Health Organization classify cell phones as possibly carcinogenic. Should you panic? Cell phones and cancer are the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Let's start by making sure that you all understand that the WHO statement doesn't mean that there's a clear link. It's more akin to saying that there could be some risk and that more research is needed. Putting cell phones in this category means they've now joined the ranks of pickled vegetables and coffee as possibly carcinogenic. So no, I wouldn't panic yet. But what should you make of all of this? Let's start with some facts. Cell phones are hugely popular. Worldwide estimates put cell phone usage at more than 3 billion users. In the United States, more than 270 million people use cell phones, including about half of children age 8 to 12. And yes, phones do emit radiation, specifically in the 800 to 2,000 megahertz range. So it's not a surprise that there's an ongoing debate as to whether the widespread use of a device that emits radiation causes cancer. But the radiation from cell phones is non-ionizing. That puts it in the camp of things like radar and microwave ovens and radio waves. This is different from ionizing radiation, like that of X-rays, radon, and cosmic rays. Those things lead to DNA changes and cause cancer. There's no evidence that non-ionizing radiation does. By the way, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth are also forms of non-ionizing radiation. There's no evidence for their causing cancer either. Many, many studies have been published in this area. The vast majority of them are what we call case-control studies. Let's review how those work. For a case-control study in this domain, you'd gather a group of people with brain tumors. Then you'd gather a group of people without brain tumors. Then you'd ask them all various questions like, do you use a cell phone? To see if there are differences between the two groups. While a retrospective case-control study like this can be an important study design, it's essential to recognize that they are among the weaker types of studies you can do. Unlike randomized controlled trials, you can't prove causation with this type of study. Unlike in prospective cohort studies, there's a real problem with what's known as recall bias. This is a type of bias that can alter your results because people with an issue, like a brain tumor, are more likely to recall things that might have caused their brain tumors than those who don't have that same problem. So the danger with case-control studies is that people with brain tumors may have heard about this theory that cell phones cause cancer, and therefore may remember that they used a cell phone more than people who don't have brain tumors. So let's try and summarize what we know. To the research. In 2008, a scientist summarized data in a systematic review of 33 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that looked at cell phones and brain tumors. A surprising number of these studies come from one group in Sweden. The reviewer found major flaws in the research that would make it difficult to draw a convincing conclusion about cell phones and brain tumors. The next year, another group published a meta-analysis of the literature in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. They felt that 23 articles were good enough to be included in the review. All of them were case-control studies. They found overall that compared to rarely or never using a cell phone, regularly using a cell phone was not significantly related to the development of malignant and benign brain tumors. Even the most recent large study in the review, known as the Interphone study, found that, and I quote, cell phone users have no increased risk for two of the most common types of brain tumor, glioma and meningioma. The plural of anecdote is not data. As human beings, we make decisions every day that trade off benefits with harms. As we've discussed before, pretty much the biggest killer of children in the United States is car accidents. Yet, no one thinks we should ban cars in order to reduce that to zero. We, as a society, accept that the quality of life derived from driving outweighs the increase in deaths of children from car accidents. If you disagree, don't drive. Almost no one makes that choice. Similarly, cell phones provide a lot of good to many people. Given the controversy, even if there was an association between cell phones and brain tumors, it would have to be really small. If such a very, very small association exists, few would likely forego their cell phone to eliminate it completely, just like they won't forego their cars. Moreover, we know that at a population level, there's been no explosion of brain tumors recently. A study published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in 2009 examined data for cancers in four countries with registries from 1974 through 2003. Over that time, almost 60,000 people in a population of 16 million adults between 10 and 79 years were diagnosed with brain tumors. While a slow increase in rates of gliomas and meningiomas was seen throughout the time period, no changes in incident trends were seen from 1998 to 2003, when you'd expect to see an increase because of cell phone use after 5 to 10 years. Case control studies are necessary for rare diseases, but cell phone use is so common that if they were dangerous right now, we'd be able to see the effect easily. That's not happening. Future work will be needed to see if they cause long-term harm, but as for now, there's very little evidence that they do.
Well, I know it's been repeated a bit these last two messages, but I hope you got a little bit out of that. So we're going to be back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
Back. So I'm going to close the show on a little nerdism. Subatomic particles and the fundamental forces explained. I hope you enjoy it and maybe you'll learn a bit of something. Become a nerd like me.
There's a lot of chatter right now in the physics world that we may have evidence that dark matter is sterile neutrinos. Finally, I can stop disinfecting my hands every time I touch neutrinos. Hi there, viewers. Julian here for D News. There has been no direct evidence of dark matter, only things that strongly suggest it must exist. But now, however, we may be onto something. The European Space Agency's XMM Newton spacecraft has noticed an unusual spike in X-ray radiation coming from the Andromeda Galaxy and the Perseus Galaxy Cluster. As our own Dr. Ian O'Neill explains in this article, atoms and baryonic particles give off distinct electromagnetic spectrums, but this spike doesn't correspond to any we know about. So, something hitherto unseen must be the culprit. While the discovery is fascinating, I want to take a minute to explain in depth what he means by baryonic particles, because it's something that links links the very, very, very small to the supermassive. Be warned, I'm going to have to explain the basics of quantum mechanics, but learning this will make you cool and interesting at cocktail parties. So, subatomic particles are divided into bosons and fermions based on their spin. The bosons have an integer spin, and the ones we've discovered are either 0 or 1, but they could be 2, 3, so on. We just haven't found them yet. There are gauge bosons, which carry force. Gluons carry the strong force, Z and W bosons carry the weak force, and our old friend the photon carries the electromagnetic force. Then there's the Higgs boson, which comes into existence when the Higgs field is excited. It proves that the Higgs field exists, and the Higgs field explains away some problems of the Standard Model. You with me so far? Okay, good, because it's about to get weird. That brings us to fermions, which have half-integer spins. Now, fermions are divided into quarks and leptons. We've discovered quarks have six flavors: up, down, charmed, strange, and top and bottom. How these quarks are combined gives us different composite subatomic particles, some of which you already know. For instance, two ups and a down make a proton, while two downs and an up make a neutron. These are called baryons, and they react to all four fundamental forces: the strong force, the weak force, gravity, and electromagnetic radiation. Because of that last one, we can observe baryonic matter directly through light. That brings us all the way back to dark matter. The theory is that since we can't see it, but we can observe its gravity, maybe it's non-baryonic. Now, if you were keeping fastidious notes, you'll notice the fermion group I haven't explained yet are leptons. Now, we've discovered three charged leptons, one of which is the electron, and three neutral leptons, which are three different flavors of the neutrino. Neutrinos have no charge and are very small, making them extremely hard to detect because they hardly interact with anything. In fact, every square centimeter of your skin gets hit with 65 billion neutrinos per second. But they just pass right on through like listless vagabonds. It's been proposed that there is a fourth flavor of neutrino, the sterile neutrino. It's called that because it would only react to something through a gravitational pull. They don't even react weakly with other matter like their three cousins. They'd be almost impossible to detect, but if there's enough of them, they could account for the gravity that keeps entire galaxies from flinging stars off into space, and maybe, just maybe, some sterile neutrinos are decaying and causing this weird spectrum of X-ray radiation. Or maybe they don't exist at all, and I just spent the last 5 minutes scrambling your brain for no reason. I'm so attracted to you.
You mean because of one of the four fundamental forces of physics, namely gravity?
Yeah, gravity, that's it.
Hey guys, thanks for watching DNews. It's Trace and Julian here. Theoretical physics can get super complicated, as you probably know. M-theories, grand unified theory, gravity waves, quantum, everything. It's crazy.
Now, the Standard Model of physics is a little easier to wrap our collective noggins around, but even still, there are knowledge gaps. For example, this week, physicists published in Physical Review Letters that they discovered a particle that might hold the universe together.
Oh. Great, no big deal then. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. But the particle, which has a name but I have no idea how to say it, is comprised of two quarks. Together, these tiny particles are three times heavier than a proton and might give hints as to how an atom's nucleus holds together.
We know the strong nuclear force holds the nucleus together, but how it works is a mystery, in spite of it being one of the four fundamental forces of physics.
Now, the four fundamental forces from strongest to weakest are the strong nuclear, the weak nuclear, electromagnetism, and gravity.
You already know what strong nuclear does. It holds atoms together, overcoming the repulsion of positively charged protons from each other. Weak nuclear is what causes the beta decay of atoms. Weak nuclear allows for the buildup of radioactive isotopes and thus the creation of something like deuterium that helps the sun burn.
Subatomic forces are very difficult to study because of the scale of the objects. So the announcement of the particle D whatever is a big deal for physicists.
Though admittedly, it doesn't really do much for you day to day.
Unlike the other two fundamental forces, which are acting on you right now. The most obvious is gravity, which holds you to the planet, holds the planet to the sun to the galaxy together, and so on and so forth. But we'll come back to that in a minute.
Electromagnetic force is what causes static electricity to hold, say, a balloon on the wall after you rub it on your head.
Or the force that makes magnets attracted or repel each other.
Both gravity and electromagnetism are properties of matter. They're directly proportional to mass and electrical charge, respectively, and they both have infinite range. The gravity of the moon is acting on you right now.
Now, the mind blower is that of all of these, gravity is the weakest. Seriously, a balloon or a rocket can overcome gravity. The Earth is unfathomably gigantic in comparison to me, and I'm defying the entirety of its gravity right now. Though, not for long.
Physicists found a particle on the quantum level that aligns to each of these four fundamental forces, mostly. The strong nuclear uses pions and gluons. The weak nuclear uses W and Z bosons.
Electromagnetic force uses photons. Yes, the same as light energy, because light is part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Gravity uses gravitons, which is tricksy.
Albert Einstein said gravity works because it curves the space-time continuum around all objects. The larger the object, the more gravity, but why is a mystery. Scientists have never found a graviton, though they have discovered gravity waves, maybe. The jury is still out.
Gravity is so confusing because we can't explain black holes with current gravity calculations, and it seems to break down at the atomic level, too.
In the end, the four fundamental forces of physics might sound decided and explored, fundamental forces, but scientists are still scratching heads a lot.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR. And